Today is the 26th of August, 2008. A few days ago, it was Krishna's birthday. Janmashtami. Janma means birthday. Ashtami means... Well, that's a good guess. Ashtami means eighth.
Oh. Eighth
century? Yeah, these are all good guesses, but they're all wrong. No.
Eighth
day of the?
Waning moon.
Of the waning moon. All birthdays, according to ancient Vedic tradition, are not calculated from a solar calendar. And we are on the, Gregorian calendar. They are always calculated from the lunar date.
That never changes.
No, it never changes. So, now, a month goes from the middle of, is marked from the middle of our solar month to the middle of the next solar month. So, like for example, just to say it roughly, from the August 15th till September 15th, that's when the sun is in Leo. Right? It's not according to the Western, as you already know, what you find in the newspaper under horoscopes. That Western calculation is erroneous. According to whom? Erroneous. Wrong. According to astronomical calculation. You can ask any astronomer worth their weight. They will tell you that the Western Zodiac is calculated incorrectly. Because it does not take into account the precession of the equinoxes, which we won't get into right at this moment. So, because the Earth spins on its axis, it has a certain wobble. So, the vernal equinox doesn't start every year in Aries on March 22nd. It goes backwards 50 seconds every year, which is a complete revolution of 25,870 years. Anyway, not to digress too much. So, the middle of August till the middle of September, the sun is in Leo. Okay. So, if Krishna's, we know that Krishna's birthday took place in that month, right? There's how many fortnights in a month? Two. Fortnight is? 14 days, 2 weeks. So we have the Shukla Paksha. This is yet another way to measure. The Shukla Paksha, Paksha means fortnight. And the Krishna Paksha. Shukla means bright or white. So what's the moon doing during the Shukla Paksha?
It's getting bigger and bigger.
Till it hits the full moon, mm-hmm. At which time it flips over to the Krishna Paksha, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to new moon. Why is it called Krishna? Dark. Because Krishna is dark. No.
Because
he's dark. Krishna also means dark. Blackish. His color is actually like a monsoon cloud. That's how they describe it. So which would be like a deep, dark blue. Bluish, grayish, like that. So, if you're born, Krishna was born on the Krishna Paksha, the eighth day of the waning moon, in the month of, I can't remember the Agrahayana, I may be wrong though, I can't remember the name of the Sanskrit name for the month. But when the sun was in Leo, his sun was in Leo, right? Which is a very kingly sign, queenly. So, Ashtami, eighth. So that's how the birthday is calculated or recounted each year. Nothing to do with the solar birthday. Because the lunar birthday is exact. Because, you know, your birthday each year, if you take the solar calendar, you say, well, my birthday is on August 17th every year. But August 17th every year will end up on a different day or a different lunar day. Right?
So, celebrating two birthdays.
Well, you can celebrate two birthdays. Sometimes they're anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks apart, your solar birthday and your lunar birthday. Anyway, so that's what Janma means, birth, and Ashtami is eighth. Eighth day of the moon. And so let's just talk a little bit about that. I might mention that Venus has now gone into Virgo. Did I talk about that last week? Venus went into Virgo, I think, yesterday. 2 days ago. And it will remain in Virgo until September 19th. Venus in Virgo is Venus debilitated. It's weak. It's not the best time for relationships when Venus is in Virgo. And what we will have are misunderstandings. They can increase. As I've said on different occasions, relationships are all about the heart. They have to be about the heart. It's a loving relationship. I'm speaking about, well, any relationship, but intimate relationships between lovers. It must be a heart-based experience. Because what happens is we drift out of the heart and into the head. And then we begin to fault find and to nitpick and to point out what's wrong and to dwell on what's wrong rather than what's right. Inevitably, I don't care how much in love you are and you might be bouncing off the walls, it's so wonderful, that will wear off and you'll get down to the nitty-gritty of day-to-day life. And you can itemize the faults of this person. My God, let me tell you. Here's my list. Let me go through it with you. You know. Naturally. Easy to do that. And as soon as you move into that, it's the beginning of the end of relationship. Because now you moved out of the heart, you're stuck in the head, and you're ticking off all the flaws. And it's eclipsing what it is you love about this person. You cannot afford ever, ever, ever to go into the head in relationship because it is the death knell. And that's not what relationship is about. It's not about that. It's about love. And love means sacrifice and surrender and acceptance and tolerance and accommodation. And all those things that, many of the things that hurt like hell when you're called upon to do them initially. But you got to keep trying because that's what love is. So, not the best time for relationships from now till September 19th. Not a good time for communication in relationship. When you find people who are born with Venus and Virgo in a birth chart, they tend to drift into the head too easily or too quickly. And it means karmically they themselves will tend to be fault find. Or they will marry somebody or choose somebody who will be a fault finder. And then the third scenario is they happily fault find each other together. You know, which is really difficult. So, like I said, Venus in Virgo, not the best time for relationships. The flip side is that Mercury on Saturday, or on Sunday, Krishna's birthday, Mercury went into Virgo too. Mercury is the opposite of Venus in Virgo. Mercury is exalted. And we talked about this last week about communication and how it's a wonderful time for communication. So, you know.
Is that communication not in relationships?
Well, you know, it can be. It could be in relationship. It depends. You know. If somebody thinks they're right and they want to be right and they're going to be right no matter what you say, well then there's not much communication going on.
So those two are kind of seeing each other?
Yeah, exactly.
So how does that work then?
Well, how do you think it might work?
I'm not sure.
You get your good days and your bad days. It depends. If somebody's intransigent, inflexible, intolerant, stubborn, good luck. People who want to be right, good luck. But if people are reasonable, understanding, loving, forgiving, kind, surrendering, then, you know, come around. Sometimes time is what's required. People need time. People say, well, you know, time heals all wounds. Yeah, or severs all ties. As the case may be, some cases it heals all wounds, in other cases it'll pop you right out of this body. Depends. It can heal many, many wounds. So, enjoy this Venus in Virgo, Mercury in Virgo. It's good for you, Venus in Virgo, because that's where your Venus is. It'll be good for you. Whenever your natal Venus, this Venus in the sky, goes on top of where your Venus was at your birth, it's a good thing. Good for love. It strengthens it. All right, so we are going to talk just briefly about the advent of Krishna. Once the world was overburdened by the military forces of different kings who were demoniac in nature, which means they were intent upon preying upon or destroying others, but they were posing themselves as the royal order. So if you say you're a king and you're bent on destroying others, that's not what kingship is. That's what demons do. Destroy others so I can stay in power, like Mugabe, for example, is doing in Zimbabwe, for example. Even he lost the election. He declared himself the winner of the election, and then he began to kill people who disagreed with him. Markandeya, how are you? We're talking about the advent of Krishna. The primary duty of kings is to look after the welfare of the people. At that time, the whole world became perturbed, and the goddess of the earth, known as Bhumi, went to see Brahma, the creator of life within the material universe, to tell of her misfortune due to the demoniac kings. In Vedic understanding, every energy, every force, every power, every notion has a personification. Everything. So, obviously we have Earth, we call her Mother Earth, but there's actually a Mother Earth. She is a woman, a goddess, a devi. And when you are a goddess or a god, meaning like an angel, archangel. Same idea. You are able to take different forms. You don't have to be in the same form all the time necessarily. You have this ability to shift. So she went, Bhumi went to see Brahma, the creator. Bhumi assumed the shape of a cow in this case, which she often does. Why did she choose cow? Why? Because cow represents the mother. And earth represents the mother. It's mother. Mother. Why is cow considered to be mother? In India, cow is sacred. Why is the cow sacred? Because she's the mother. When you're born, you are given breast milk. Well, nowadays, less and less. Maybe not at all. And then, when that's finished, what are you given? After you're taken off the breast?
Cow's milk.
Cow's milk.
There's been a question that has been asked also time. They say, why is the cow special for you? And I say that because maybe in ancient time they found the cow. They said they got the milk, and then for the milk they can make yogurt and cheese and lots of things. And the butter, for the butter they make ghee, which is what called purified butter. Mm-hmm. And then you can use it as a fuel for the lamp.
Yeah.
And then you can also use for cooking stuff as well, because even according to now, the lots of nutritionists now, they say that when you're cooking, deep frying, especially ghee is the best thing, because any other oil or any other kind of thing, it can turn into trans fat, which is carcinogenic, because the ghee is the highest.
Sure.
And then cattle dung, in India, they use as a fuel as well,
uh-huh.
and for fertilizer. Yeah. And after when they burn this fuel and the ashes, you can use ashes for actually cleaning the utensil as well, uh-huh. and it has a brilliant property for the purify.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of cow urine, they use in lots of Ayurvedic medicine as well.
Yeah.
It has lots of medicinal properties.
It's antiseptic. Cow urine and cow dung is antiseptic.
This animal is fantastic.
There's nothing about the animal that isn't good.
Mm-hmm.
It's all good. So, Mother Earth assumed the form of a cow. Mother cow. Presented herself before Brahma with tears in her eyes. She was bereaved and weeping, which invoked Brahma's compassion. She related the unfortunate circumstance of the earth. And after hearing this unfortunate circumstance, Brahma became much aggrieved, and he at once started for the ocean of milk, where Lord Vishnu, or God, who pervades everything, lives. So, somewhere within the universe, Vishnu as Paramatma. Paramatma is inside the body we have Atma and Paramatma, soul and super soul. Right? So, when Vishnu expands himself, life can only be sustained through the presence of God. So, God enters into everything. This entering into everything is Paramatma, Supersoul. But Supersoul also has a localized place that he lives in the universe, and that is on the ocean of milk. And he lies down on the serpent couch, Sheshanaga, which we've told you about many times. And that's Balaram, his brother. Okay. So, Brahma went to see Vishnu about this problem, about the kings on earth creating problems. Brahma was accompanied by all the lesser gods, headed by Shiva, and Bhumi also followed. Arriving on the shore of the milk ocean, Brahma began to pray to Lord Vishnu. Brahma could understand the message transmitted by Lord Vishnu through his heart. And he revealed it to the other gods for their immediate response. Brahma was inspired initially to create all the diversity in the universe according to Vedic understanding. How was he inspired? Through his meditation. Through his tapa. Tapa means austerity, penance, sacrifice, meditation. Do the work. In other words, go do the work. And in his meditation, Vishnu appeared and revealed, this is how you create the diversity in the universe. And which mantra did he get? Kling Krishnaya, Govindaya, Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. Which we did last week and which we're going to look at again this week. That was the mantra that inspired Brahma to create all the diversity in the universe. So again now, through the heart, Brahma is communicated to by Vishnu, and then he tells the other gods what was said. The message was that God himself would appear on the earth very soon, along with his supremely powerful potencies. As long as he remained on the earth planet to execute his mission of annihilating the demons and protecting the devotees, the gods should also remain there or appear there to assist him. When a king travels someplace, does he go alone? No. Does he go with him and his wife? No. He goes with an entourage. Same thing with God. God never goes alone. He has a whole entourage. So he asks the gods to then take birth in various personages ahead of time or simultaneously so that everything will be in place when he gets there. That's what he said. They should immediately take birth in the family of the Yadu dynasty, wherein the Lord would also appear in due course of time. The Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, Krishna, would personally appear as the son of Vasudev. That's the father. Vasudev was a king, prince. Before his appearance, all the gods, along with their wives, should take birth in various virtuous families in the world just to assist the Lord in executing his mission. Virtuous families. Vasudev married Devaki, the daughter of King Ugrasen and the sister of Kamsa. On their wedding day, Kamsa, the brother of the bride, presented them with a golden chariot. Lovely gift. A golden Mercedes equivalent. And then they mounted the chariot, and Kamsa mounted the chariot to drive them to their new home in their new car. On the way, a voice from the sky, a disembodied voice, spoke, saying, "O Kamsa, you fool." Well, you got that part right. "The eighth son born of Devaki will certainly kill you. He'll be the death of you." That's what the voice said. Hearing this, Kamsa, whose middle name was not Patience, became furious. He grabbed Devaki by the hair, and raising his sword, he was about to cut off her head immediately. That's Kamsa. Pleading with Kamsa not to kill her, Vasudev, who had just married her, said, Kamsa, wait, don't be hasty. Don't worry. What we'll do is we'll take the eighth child born, we'll give this child to you. You can do with him what you want. Please don't kill your sister now. So, in fact, he said, that didn't have much of an effect on Kamsa. So Vasudeva said, okay, I'll give you all the children, all of them, just don't kill them. Whoever is born, we'll give them to you. As soon as they're born. Kamsa flew into a rage and immediately had Vasudeva and Devaki chained and imprisoned and placed under guard. Honeymoon, here we come. It couldn't have been a very good marriage. They didn't calculate the marriage time very, very well at all. No. Correct. The first son born to Devaki and Vasudeva was named Kirtiman. One day, a celestial sage from the higher realms named Narada visited Kamsa and told him that the members of the Yadu dynasty, who were his relatives and friends, were mostly gods who had taken birth to assist Vishnu, who was also due to be born into this same family, in relieving the burden of the earth from the negative forces of military power of the kings. Narada also informed Kamsa that Kamsa himself was the incarnation of the demon known as Kalanemi in his previous lifetime, and that in that lifetime Vishnu had also killed Kamsa. So now he was having a real case of deja vu, because this was meant to happen again. To be safe, Kamsa had their firstborn son Kirtiman put to death. He then killed every subsequent child born to Devaki. And the way he killed them was, as soon as he heard that the child was born, he'd go into the prison, he'd take the child, and he'd dash it against the stone wall. That's what he did.
You have to fill in as well what those kids, they were working off karma by being born for only a couple of minutes, and then they were allowed to go back to, they had all done something naughty, and they had to come back to human, but only for a couple of moments.
They were cursed to taking birth on the earth where none of them wanted to go. But the blessing was they only had to remain for a very short time, and Kamsa threw them against the wall and they could go back. So that was the other flip side of the story. There's always more than meets the eye. There's never only what meets the eye. So he killed all. Historically upon this earth, power-hungry kings and queens have killed their own fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, and relatives to carry out their own avaricious ends. Is this not true? You see all this, all kinds of examples of this. True to his demoniac character, Kamsa also imprisoned his own father at that time, King Ugrasen, and usurped the throne. So now he was the big cheese. He was in charge. Each year thereafter, in due course of time, Devaki gave birth to a child. Thus, she gave birth to 6 male children. And Kamsa, thinking each of the babies to be the incarnation of Vishnu, although they weren't, killed them one after another. Devaki's 7th child, a boy who was the only other incarnation of Vishnu, was removed from her womb and placed in the womb of Rohini, another wife of Vasudeva. So Vasudeva had Devaki and he had Rohini. So they took her out of that womb and placed her, or took him out of the womb and placed him in the womb of Rohini, where he grew to term and had a healthy birth. So Kamsa didn't get his hands on him. Kamsa was particularly afraid of the 8th child, but after the visit of Narada, he came to the conclusion that any child might be Krishna. Therefore, it was better to kill all the babies who took birth from the womb of Devaki. Lord Krishna, first of all, situated himself in the pure heart of Vasudeva. So now this is Vasudeva. He's in the prison. So what Krishna did, he entered Vasudev's heart. And was then transferred into the spotless heart of Devaki, his mother. Like all incarnations of Vishnu, he was not put into the womb of Devaki by seminal discharge. So now you got the whole concept of the virgin birth. Right. No seminal discharge. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, by his inconceivable potency, can appear in any way he chooses. It is not necessary for him to appear according to human laws of impregnation and birth. On the heavenly planets, how is it? Do you remember now? Do they come out fully grown, or there's no a big long gestation period? They have them right away, and it's there's no when you're on the heavenly planets, there's no suffering. You know, there's no pain, and there's no punishment of any kind. So. I don't remember the details, but.
Does that mean that Jesus could have been animated at conception?
Well, there's so many things that you're going to hear in this story that where did they get all these notions from?
Yeah. You know. Like the financial of Nicaea, what's his name? Constantine.
Emperor Constantine wanted to
amalgamate.
And organize the church. You know, depending what you read and what you believe, there were six very, very popular gods or prophets at the time. And one was one was Jesus.
Oh, okay. And then the other was Krishna.
One was Krishna. I can't remember them all now, but. So they picked two, and they amalgamated them, and that became Jesus Christ.
Jesus Krishna. Jesus Christ.
God's Jesus Christ. And most of the Christ story was taken from the Persian myth of Mithra. Almost.
Persian.
Mm-hmm. Took lots of different stories from different religious.
And attributed them to.
And traditions and put them all into the Bible, so it might be.
So whether there even was a Jesus Christ according to this, this is some scholar who spent 30 years putting all this stuff together.
Because these other stories that are in the Bible were predated in other books.
You know, like the flood and all that. I mean, all that stuff's in the Vedas. So you're going to hear some of this right now. You know, that's what I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to wrest your Christian faith from you. I'm just saying we did some reading on this and stumbled upon that. And it's a bit of an eye-opener, you know. Okay. At that time, there was an atmosphere of peace and prosperity everywhere. This is when Vishnu entered the heart of Devaki and in the womb of Devaki. There were auspicious stars visible in the sky, and in all towns and villages and pasturing grounds, as well as within the minds of all people, there were signs of good fortune. The rivers were filled with water, and the lakes were beautifully decorated with lotus flowers. The forests were populated with beautiful birds and peacocks. All the birds within the forests began to sing with sweet voices. And the peacocks began to dance along with their mates. The wind blew very pleasantly, carrying the aroma of different flowers. And the sensation of bodily touch was very pleasing. At home, the Brahmins, who were accustomed to offering sacrifices in the sacred fire, found their homes very pleasant for offerings. Due to disturbances created by the demoniac kings, the sacred fires and the sacrificial performances had all been almost stopped in the houses of the Brahmins or priests. But now they could find the opportunity to offer the sacrifices peacefully. At the point of Krishna's appearance, the Brahmins were filled with joy because they could hear transcendental sounds in the sky proclaiming the appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Well, he also heard the angels going over Bethlehem. Anyway, so everything became very pleasing. When a high personality is born, things become very pleasing. When demons are born, it's usually in a storm and a terrible, scary time. Interestingly, on Sunday, the moon was in Taurus. At Krishna's birth, Krishna had moon in Taurus in the constellation of Rohini. Moon is exalted in Taurus, as powerful as it can be. And that's the sign of Venus. So moon and Venus together is about as romantic as you can get. It's a very, very romantic conjunction. So here is moon in the sign of Venus in the constellation ruled by the moon, which is Rohini. We just had that again on Sunday. So the chance of that happening each year of somebody's birth is very, very rare.
So that just happened Sunday. Was that lasting for a period of time?
No, that's 2 days. That's all it lasts. But it means that it happened that Krishna's birthday fell on the exalted day of the moon, you know, on Sunday. Okay. At the seashore, there was the sound of mild waves, and above the sea, there were clouds in the sky, which began to thunder very pleasingly. When things were arranged in this manner, Lord Vishnu, who was residing within the heart of every living being, appeared around midnight as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Before Devaki, he appeared in front of Devaki, his mother. His birth took place around midnight. If you're born roughly a muhurta on either side of midnight or noon, muhurta is 48 minutes, 24 minutes. Roughly half an hour, I think it's 24 minutes. On either side of midnight or noon, that's when the kings and the queens are born. This is not to say that kings or queens cannot be born almost any time of night or day, because they can. But many, many kings and queens are born a half an hour on either side of midnight or noon. Very common. So here Krishna is born right at midnight. When was Jesus born? Midnight? See? See what I mean? Okay. Vishnu said to his mother, Devaki, and to his father, Vasudev, in the prison, "I know you are very concerned about me." Now, this is Vishnu in his grown adult form. In his forearm form, there he is there, second from the right. That's Vishnu in his forearm form. And he said, "I know you're very concerned about me and afraid of Kamsa and what he might do. Therefore, I request that you take me immediately to Gokula," which is another place nearby, "and exchange me with the daughter who has just been born to Yashoda." Yashoda was the wife of Nanda. They were not kings. They were Vaishyas. They were farmers. They were cow protectors. They looked after cows. They were cowherds. That's what their business was.
He was the head of the village. Huh?
He was the head. Nanda Maharaj. Mm. He was the head, the main guy of the whole village of Gokul. So he says that Yashoda is about to give birth to a daughter, and I want you to exchange the babies. Put me with Yashoda and bring the daughter back here to the prison. That was what he was to do. Having spoken thus to his father and mother, the Lord turned himself into an ordinary child in their presence and remained silent. Now he says, no crying. No crying did he make. Being ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudev, his father, prepared to take his son from the delivery room, and exactly at that time, a daughter was born to Nanda and Yashoda nearby in the town of Gokul. This daughter was the personification of Yoga Maya. Yoga Maya.
Durga?
No, the internal spiritual potency of the Lord. Durga is Maha Maya. So God has internal energy, which is the spiritual potency, and he has external energy, which is the material potency. What are you looking at now? This is the external energy. This is Durga. You know Durga? This is Durga energy. That manifestation of the goddess. Yoga Maya would be Lakshmi or Radha. They're Yoga Maya. Internal spiritual potency. It's different. Okay. So this is Yoga Maya. The internal spiritual potency of the Lord. By the influence of this divine internal potency, all the residents of Kamsa's palace were overwhelmed with deep sleep. Just like Sleeping Beauty. I wonder which one came first. And all the palace doors opened, although they were barred and shackled with iron chains. That's the door opening. Pretty good, huh? So, the night was very dark, but as soon as Vasudev took Krishna in his arms and went out, he could see everything as though it was daytime. When Vasudev was carrying Krishna, the darkness of the night disappeared. At the same time, there was thunder in the sky and severe rainfall. Vasudev arrived at the bank of the Yamuna River and saw that the water of the Yamuna River was filled with waves and that the whole span was full of white water. A big river with white water might be great for rafting, but crossing, it's a whole other story. Though churning furiously, the river parted and gave way for Vasudev. Doesn't that sound familiar? 5,000 years old.
I'm trying to hide from Harold.
From Herod. Harold or Herod?
Evening Harold.
Evening Harold. Tried to keep my name out of the Evening Harold. Okay. Reaching the other side, Vasudev went to the place of Nanda in Gokul, where he saw that all the cowherd men were fast asleep. Everybody was under the spell, sleeping. Silently, he entered the house of Yashoda, and without difficulty, he exchanged his son with the newly born baby girl. Then he returned to the prison and silently put the girl onto the lap of his wife, Devaki. He again clamped the shackles on himself so that Kamsa could not discover what had happened. Mother Yashoda understood that a child had been born to her, but because she was very tired due to the labor of childbirth, she had fallen asleep. When she awoke, she could not remember whether she had given birth to a boy or a girl. Turns out it was a boy. It's a boy. Been changed. Kongsa's guards awoke and heard the newborn child crying. Uh-oh. Here we go. Number eight. No, number seven.
Number eight.
It's number eight, but I don't know what happened. Did they know that? See, number seven was Balaram, and he had been taken out of her womb and put into the womb of his other wife, Revati.
Okay.
Right? You see what I mean? So I'm not quite sure. He didn't get a chance to kill number seven, you see. But this was technically number eight. Correct. So, Kongsa's guards awoke and heard the newborn child crying. Kongsa was waiting to hear the news of the child's birth, and the guards immediately informed him that the child had been born. At that time, Kongsa got up from his bed very quickly and exclaimed, "Now the cruel death of my life has been born." Kongsa became perplexed now that his death was approaching. Immediately he proceeded toward the place where the child had been born. Devaki, on seeing her brother approaching, prayed in a very meek attitude to her brother, "My dear brother, please do not kill this female child. I promise that this child will be wed to your son. Please don't kill her. You are not to be killed by a female child. The prophecy said you're to be killed by a male child. So please don't kill her." Kongsa was so cruel that he did not listen to the pitiful prayers of his sister Devaki. He forcibly grabbed the newborn child to rebuke his sister and attempted to mercilessly dash her upon the stone. But instantly, the child slipped out of his hands and rose into the sky and appeared as goddess Durga with eight arms. She was decorated with beautiful garments, flower garlands, and ornaments. In her eight hands, she held a bow, arrows, a lance, a sword, a conch shell, a disc, a club, a shield, pretty much weaponry. From above, the goddess addressed Kongsa. She was floating in the air in all her glory. We've talked about Durga. Durga's whole thing is to crush the male ego. She lives for it. She loves it. And she's really good at it.
Can I smell that?
Yeah. My dear, I would think you'd have no problem with that. So, she said, "You demon, how can you kill me? The child who will kill you is already born before me somewhere else in the world. Don't be so cruel to your poor sister Devaki." Having warned Kongsa, Durga disappeared. After hearing these words, Kongsa became very much overwhelmed with fear. Out of pity for himself, he immediately released Vasudev and Devaki from prison. And now they were free to go. And he didn't get the daughter. And, of course, the next morning, when he came to his senses, his first order was what? Go throughout the kingdom and find all the newborn male children and kill them. Have you heard that one before?
That's
the Bible.
That's Jesus. So, there you have it. Krishna lived. And he then... He killed Kamsa when Krishna was 12 years old. He moved from Vrindavan. He was raised in the country. He was a... They would laugh at him. Some of the warriors would laugh at him because he was a coward boy. Oh yeah, nothing but a cowherd. You know, raising cows, looking after cows. You know, we're real warriors. Well, he was born into a warrior family, but his foster family was a Vaishya family, or, you know.
Did he know that they were fosters?
Yeah, he knew. He knew. They did not know. They did not know throughout his childhood that he wasn't actually their son. They thought he was their son. And they were told somewhere around the time he was 12 that who he really was and what he had come there to do. And when he moved to Mathura, which is the city, he went there on the pretext with his brother Balaram, who's the seventh child, and placed in the womb of Revati. And the two of them grew up together. So Balaram's, a year older. And the two of them went to Mathura, to the city, on the pretext of entering a wrestling competition with hardcore, famous adult wrestlers. Well, you wouldn't enter a 12-year-old against these guys, and these guys were powerful, famous, and they went there to the wrestling match. But when Krishna was a child, he exhibited uncommon behavior. Many demons. Kamsa finally figured out where he was, finally meaning at a very young age, he was told where Krishna was, who he was, and where he was, and he was the guy who was going to kill him. And this is when Krishna was still a baby. So then Kamsa would solicit the help of very powerful demons who could shapeshift. And now you go over there to Gokul. One of the first ones he sent was Putana. Putana, of course, in Italian, a puta is a, or in Spanish, puta is a whore. So this isn't puta, it's putana. Close. And she was just a god awful, ugly thing. But she turned herself into a beautiful, beautiful woman. And she was one of the first ones sent to kill Krishna. And it was very common in those days to, when you come to see somebody's baby, if you have breast milk, because, you know, you had a baby recently, you know, like to wet nurse, women wet nurse on behalf. So for someone to wet nurse your child, I mean, it's kind of just very acceptable. And, well, sure, of course you can nurse them. You know, nowadays it's like, can I hold them? Oh, yeah, you can hold them. And then she flips it. And what are you doing? But back then it was acceptable. And it was a very gracious thing to offer. Not unusual. So here's this beautiful woman that came, you know, or the coward woman there, and oh, your son, he's so lovely, and may I hold him, may I feed him? Oh, of course you may. And as soon as she put the nipple in his mouth, she then grew to this gigantic size, you know, huge. And of course there was poison in the breast milk. and or poison on the nipple, or I can't remember exactly. And that was the idea, that she would poison him with her breast. And what he did, and but immediately she went to her true form, this ugly Rakshasi. And what did he do? He sucked the life force out of her through her breast. So there were very, very powerful ghastly demons that were sent to kill him off. And he killed them all. But you can imagine his parents were in heavy duty anxiety in many, many cases, because, you know, he'd be ending up in these very strange circumstances with these powerful demons trying to kill him. And, you know, what was this about? They didn't know who he was, you know. Who is this? And they think he's just a little kid. But in every circumstance, these demons will somehow be killed. You know, they're like... But Mother Yashoda, come here to me, Krishna. You know, let me... Stay away from those bad people, kind of thing, you know. Only I can protect you. Sort of like this. There was a story where he was, you know, like children... He was eating... No, that was Chaitanya using. He was out sitting on in the courtyard and he was eating dirt.
As you do.
As you do when you're a child. And Yashoda runs up. Oh, Krishna, what are you doing with the dirt all over you? Let me see. What are you doing with the dirt in your mouth? Open up. Like this. He opens his mouth. And in his mouth, she can see all the worlds. All the universes manifest. The whole material creation is inside his mouth. She's like... Okay, never mind now. Come on inside. Let me get you clean. You know, what was that about? You know, I'll ignore that. Let's get you inside. Things like this that you couldn't possibly explain. But she's in mother mode. And it also, it's an illustration that, which is so nice about Vedic understanding. You can enter into all these different relationships with God. Yashoda and Nanda, who raised Krishna, were yogis in another lifetime who wanted to have direct association with God. Most people think of associating with God as awe and reverence. Oh, my dear Lord. You know, the most they can ever imagine is just bowing down to this frighteningly fearful deity who could smite you in a moment's notice. And that's on reverence. But you can go beyond that to service. You can serve God. You can go beyond that to friendship. You can hang out with him and be his best bud. His best buddy. His good mate. You can go beyond that and become his parent, where you're giving him orders. Now you come with me, young man. Get you sorted. That's what Yashoda and Nanda were doing. They were in charge. You can go beyond that and enter into conjugal relationship, become his lover. And that's what all the gopis were, all the cowherd maidens were lovers of God, who were powerful yogis, who qualified themselves to have the highest possible relationship that one can have. All of these relationships are available down here in the material world with other humans. And the highest one out of those relationships, they go up in the same order, is intimacy, is conjugal, sexual, loving intimacy. That's the highest relationship. Right? Those people who are in that relationship are more committed to each other than they are with all the rest of these relationships. Correct? Well, so, by the same token, as above, so below. So that's what's possible. If you don't like the idea, or you have a hard time wrapping your mind around it, then you pick the kind of relationship that's comfortable for you. And you meditate on that. The more advanced you become, and the more you understand how anything is possible, the more anything becomes possible. So, in the case of Vasudeva and Devaki, they were parents of God. Were not Joseph and Mary purported to be parents of Jesus? And of course, now, what's very popular in vogue now is that Mary Magdalene was his wife. Correct? This Da Vinci Code, etc. Buddha was married.
Jesus had kids?
I didn't say that.
No, I'm just saying, what'd you say?
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Matthew, Mark. Yeah, well, this is it, you know. But Buddha was a prince, and he was married, and I think he had a family, and he left.
He was renounced?
Well, he renounced it all. They hid from him all pain and suffering. So he didn't see that there was no pain and suffering in the world because he was too compassionate. And they knew they'd lose him as soon as he figured out there was pain and suffering. So anyway, our position here in the material world is like this. You can see a crazy man walking down the street in the city center, and he's talking, mumbling to himself, and he's picking garbage out of a bin or food, and he's eating it, and he's unclean, and he hasn't washed, and he hasn't slept, and his clothes are rags. Who is he? His parents might be very wealthy. He might be from a good family. He might have all facility. And they, of course, they would want him to be with them and take advantage of what they have to offer. But he doesn't. Because he's crazy. He has forgotten his true position. Welcome to the material world, you, my fellow crazy people.
So sit around that by me again. He's forgotten. He's feeling. He's a prophet.
Your father is God, and you're running around down here eating unhealthy food, being in misery, and whatever else kind of stressful and difficult circumstances you may find yourself in, because you've forgotten your true identity, who you really are, which is the son or the daughter of God himself. He doesn't want you down here digging through the bins. He wants you home, where you belong. So, when will you come back and enjoy all the opulence? Who's the most wealthy guy in the universe? Your dad. He's your father.
So, can I ask you, are there demons here keeping us away from that?
There are demons, but that's not really. Most of us are not afflicted with demons keeping us away from anything. Most of us are just sidetracked.
Mm-hmm.
There are demons, but we're just running a different agenda. I mean,
we're forced to jump through a million hoops just to get from one point to the next. It's mm-hmm. not that we don't.
Yeah, but we're diverted. We're sidetracked with sense gratification. Our main goals, you want to find out the main goal of society, look at the billboards. That's where the main goals are. So if your goals are what you see on the billboards, well then, your main goals are to enjoy yourself. Enjoy your senses, because that's what the billboards are putting forth. But that's not your true identity. your true goal is not to satisfy your material senses, to act like a body. Your highest goal and your highest benefit is to act like a soul and remember who you are and go back home where you belong, which is the spiritual world. And stop acting like a madwoman or a madman down here in fantasy land. That's what this is. It's fantasy land. And then you die. It's fantasy land and then you die. You go to Disneyland and then it's 9 o'clock, it's closed. It's over. So, God comes to, when God appears on earth, yada hidharmasya, glanir bhavati bharata, abhyutthanam adharmasya, tadatmanam srijamyam. Yeah, you know it. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious principle, virtue, and a predominant rise of irreligion, vice, or hurtful behavior, or behavior that engenders negative karma, at that time, I descend myself. This is Krishna speaking. Yada hidharmasya. I'll show it to you in a minute. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chidushkritam dharma samstapanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. So, in order to deliver the pious or the good people and to annihilate the miscreants, the evildoers, and to reestablish the principles of dharma, virtue, duty, I advent myself. I come myself. Sambhavami, yuge. Yuga, what's a yuga?
Age.
Kali Yuga. The age of Kali, the Iron Age. Yuge. Millennium after millennium. Yuga after yuga. Time after time. In every day of Brahma, remember we were talking about how long Brahma's life was one night? The Creator. And in one day of Brahma, every day of Brahma, Vishnu comes once. And I'll read you one more verse here because this one's important. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo viti tatvataha tyatva deham punar janma naiti mam iti so Arjuna. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities. This is God talking. It's God's words. Who else talks like this? One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, after leaving his body, take birth again in this material world, but attains to my eternal abode, O Arjuna. So what does that mean? If you actually come to realize, believe, know, understand that God is not, God's appearance is not material like yours and mine, but his form and his appearance and his activities and pastimes are transcendental or spiritual or godlike in nature. If you simply accept that as being true, you will not take birth again. That's what he says there. It's that simple. It's the belief that this is true. And you will not be born again. It's that easy. You know, and then people say, yeah, well, if God was here right now, boy, I would surrender to him. You know, that's what they'll say. Jesus Christ, right? Let's stone him. Let's hang him. Let's crucify him. Right? So most people, they wouldn't recognize or appreciate God when he does appear. Yeah, but God is in everything, but that doesn't mean that everybody is godly or godlike.
No.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying this is the actual incarnation of God. You know, we can look at somebody else, another person, say, well, like we always do, that person screwed up, they're messed up, they do this wrong, they do that wrong. And we fault find. And that's because this person is still conditioned by so many material desires and notions and beliefs and behaviors. You can say, yeah, but this, you know, can't take that person seriously. So it's easy to write off a human being. But it's not about believing in a human being. This is about believing in God, the possibility of God appearing himself. This is nothing to do with religion. This is not a religion. No one began this religion. There's no starting point, like there is in Christianity or Buddhism or Islam. There's no starting. Somebody didn't come and start Vedanta or Vedic. This is just the history and pastimes of God in the universe.
And with global warming, is there anything to learn about that?
Yeah, we're in a minor golden age, sort of like a minor period of Jupiter and a major period of Rahu. And you know, there's conjecture about when the time is, and it's meant to last for some 10,000 years. And this has been a rise in consciousness, but because we're in the major Iron Age, things are still unraveling, and they're headed toward the advancement of destruction. But within that framework is a minor golden age.
When it comes to the end of creation, and that the 100 years of drought, 100 years of floods,
yeah,
constant, and you know the end's coming.
Yeah, you know the end's coming when it starts raining for 100 years. And then there's followed by 100 years of drought, and then the whole place catches fire. Well, you see, the creation, according to Vedic understanding, is manifest and then unmanifest. Mm. We talked about that one night. Well, yeah, it's God breathing out and breathing in.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes, you see, when your soul, as you are, still conditioned by the material world, material behavior and belief, then you will take birth over and over again. But if the creation at that time goes into a state of dormancy, then you will be put into a state of dormancy or suspended animation. Well, you know, while we're sort of during the nighttime of the creation, where everything is dormant. So you will go into the state of dormancy, just like you do at night when you go to bed and you go to sleep. Where are you? Well, your body's lying in the bed. Are you aware of it? No, you're not. You forget all about it. And you go on your little dream tour and whatever else you do. And then you wake up in the morning and you go, oh, yeah, I know who I am. I know where I live. Here, oh, that's my house. And that's one of the hens waking me up outside, from outside. And there we go. You know. So it's the same thing that happens at night. Same example.
Right.
Are we more conscious at nighttime when we don't forget it? Are we more free at nighttime when we're in today?
Yeah, perhaps in some ways, but you can. No, you can travel. You can astral travel, but it's like anything else. You have to practice it. You have to practice. You can become very conscious of what happens to you while you sleep, but you have to conscientiously practice it, and then you can begin to direct your wanderings.
Does that mean then we can direct? If we can direct our sleep, can we direct at our time of death?
Yeah, of course. It's called yoga. Yoga Siddhi.
But that's if you're unconscious, right? You're dying. Is that what you mean?
Yeah,
hopefully you'd be conscious.
Yeah, I'd like to be conscious, but I always think of those people who die instantly, like in fire and things.
That is really, really bad karma.
It's like, how do you prepare yourself?
You don't. It's real negative karma to die a violent death or to die in some kind of natural disaster or crash or hurricane or tsunami, you name it. Because when the soul is forced out of the body so quickly, unexpectedly, and violently, most of those people don't even know that they're dead. And that's why you get these souls floating. I told you the story about one of my clients was...
her daughter?
And that's a different story. Was a flight attendant with American Airlines.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a plane crash. There's two women, so let's just say Judy and Janet. So my client is Janet. I don't remember her name now. It was many years ago. And another flight attendant, Judy, was killed in the plane crash. Everybody died. All the crew, all the passengers, 200 and some people. So Janet, my client, then gets on board her next flight because she's scheduled. And she's back in the galley before the passengers come on. She goes back, and standing in the galley is Judy in her ghostly form, her spirit form, who was killed in the plane crash. And Janet can see Judy. And Judy's busy working away. And Janet says, "Judy? Oh, hi, Janet. How's it going?" "Good. What are you doing here?" "Well, I'm scheduled. I'm on the roster for this flight."
It's dedication.
Well, it's what you do. You keep doing what you do. And she says, "Well, yeah, but did you not hear about that crash? You know, that flight you were on? Oh, God, it was terrible. Yeah, all those people got killed. Yeah, that's too bad." "Yeah, well, everybody got killed, Judy." "What? Everybody got killed. You died too." And she looked at her and she vanished. She split.
She remembers.
No. No, I don't think she did. I think she just ran away. See, they don't know. All right. Well, it's almost 10. Let's just do a very, very short meditation, and then we'll wrap it up. Close your eyes. Breathe, relax, and let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear and apprehension to drain from your body totally, completely. Relax. breathe and let go. Deeply, deeply relax. All right, you're in a beautiful forest. And you step into a clearing in this fragrant forest, gentle breezes. And there, standing, is Krishna. What's he doing? When he sees you, how does he respond? What is his attitude, his disposition? How do you respond to him? He has a gift for you, and he presents that to you now. What is that gift? What are you to do with it? Continue until you've finished all the steps. And when you're done, return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed. And that peace. And you can open your eyes. All right. Was he there? Did you see him? Good. Now, our friend, Dr. Marcus Shmika, is coming September 4th to speak on Vastu, the origin of feng shui.
That's
Thursday week. And we have booked Still Oregon Park Hotel as per Jan's recommendation. And we're asking 10 euros only to cover the cost of having rented the room. And he'll be speaking. I think it'll be good. So anyway, okay. Om Tat Sat. Hare Krishna.